are starting a series. I don't know how long it will go, but at least for a week or two, we're going to talk about the Torah. We're going to talk about the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. And the natural place to start in that, it would be the beginning, right? Let's just get right into it. Okay, now this has all come about because this fall we looked at some scriptures that really should frame, and I think, and that I propose, should frame how we look at the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, okay? First of all, Jesus said many times in this various forms of this statement and various other things similar to this, or, you know, all over the Gospels, all over the New Testament, really. And Jesus replied, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments." So the law, the Torah, and the prophets, the Nevi'im, they are both, everything is based on love your God, love God, love your neighbor. Okay? So if we are grasping the Hebrew Scriptures, if we are grasping the Old Testament right, what we get out of all of it is love God, love people. Okay? That's the first proposal. And the second one is out of Nehemiah 8. I'm not going to spend too much time background here, but the kingdom of Judah, people from the kingdom of Judah were coming out of the exilic period. They were, you know, coming out of Babylon back to their homeland. And many of them, for the first time, were hearing the law, because mostly of the law, the Torah, the Old Testament, because this was, you know, largely compiled and formalized, you know, by these scribes who were working through this exile period. You know, it was largely composed in this period. So these people were gathered together, learning, hearing these words read, meeting them for the first time, right? So they heard the Old Testament, the Torah, read to them for the first time. And Nehemiah said, and okay, because they heard this read, they had this big public ceremony, this public reading of the law. And people read it, they paid attention, but then what? They were just heartbroken and sad and mournful. All right? You know, the Old Testament can sound that way, right? You ever read Leviticus? So there was just this heavy weight, and it caused this deep sorrow and mourning for these people. But Nehemiah said, wait, no, don't cry. There's no crying in Jerusalem. They said, go, do not weep, do not mourn. Go and enjoy choice food and sweet drinks. And send some to those who have nothing prepared. This day is holy to our Lord. Do not grieve, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. And it goes on to say that these people then understood what the words of the law. They understood the Torah. They understood what they had heard, and it caused them joy. They went forth in joy, and they did this. They threw this massive party because they actually understood what all this stuff meant. So the second proposal is it brings joy. If we are grasping the Torah, if we are grasping the Hebrew Scriptures, if we are grasping the Old Testament, it brings joy. And if it doesn't, we aren't understanding it. Okay? So you're with me, kind of this framework as we start to move into this. It's about loving God, it's about loving people, and it brings joy, or at least starts to pave a path toward joy. Okay? You ready? So let's just dive into it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. The Bible opens up with God made everything. That has all come from Yahweh. He made it all. In a very, very poetic way of saying that. You know, Genesis 1 is not strictly, it is very poetic. It is poetry, but it's not strictly a poem, right? And the structure of this, as you read it, and if you were to take, you know, the first half of the book of Genesis, or big chunks, or at least several chapters at once, what you begin to see is that Genesis 1, literally speaking, serves as a prologue, this opening. It is this very, you know, elevated prose, poetry, however you want to say it, this It's this beautiful opening prologue to kind of introduce you to this material. Then you start with narrative. And these narratives, these stories are broken up by 11 statements of these are the generations of, or these genealogies we have, right? So as you start to read this literarily, you get the narratives, and they're tied together with these genealogical statements or time past or these ways of tying these stories together. But it begins with this sweeping, huge, big, beautiful poem at the beginning, right? This prologue. Verse 3 says, "And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and he called the darkness night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. God called the vault sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered in one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. But God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from night. Let them serve as signs to mark sacred times and days and years, and let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase in the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Isn't that pretty?
Yeah.
You know, that's that the language and the repetition and just the structure of that. It's beautiful language and beautiful ideas. You kind of see this this symmetry, just in, you know, even beyond just the literary structure and the literary beauty there. You see this symmetry. It's kind of like a butterfly, the two halves of a butterfly. When you see the day, he makes in the first 3 days, he makes these habitats. You know, the day, night, sky and water, and then the dry land, including plants. And then on the second half, the other butterfly wing fills it with the day with the sun and the night with the moon and the stars and the sky with the birds. On day five, the sky with the birds and the water with the sea creatures. And day six, the land animals and mankind. It's just this beautiful, beautifully structured thing. I want to think about, as we start to think about this, I want to think about, there's so many different ways of looking at this text in Genesis 1, right? Right, Steve? Steve and I talk about this periodically. We talk about this a lot. Think about what it is that we have here, this text in Genesis 1. I'll think about the nature of it, about this text, what this text is, and you know what it can be to different people. What is this picture? I've used this here many, many, many times, probably half a dozen times over the years. Anybody want to say what this is? Huh? Yeah, it's the Hubble. It's a picture from the Hubble Ultra Deep Field High Definition Telescope, right? So what you see, some of these bright fuzzy ones here and here and here, some of these big bright fuzzy blobs are what they did. They pointed this massive, amazingly advanced telescope. You can imagine ourselves, we're in this disk, right? I don't have a Frisbee. Why is there never a Frisbee up here when you need one? But if you can imagine, okay, if this was round, this would be our galaxy, right? Okay, it's, you know, kind of planar. It's a spiral galaxy. The Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. Okay, so as we look through the galaxy like this, you see far, far more stars. Right? That's why the Milky Way looks like it does, because we're looking along one long axis through the galaxy, right? Okay, but if you look through this way, you see fewer stars, okay? So they found one of the views from, you know, we're here in the middle of this galaxy somewhere, looking outward from it, not along its, you know, long axis here, but looking outward from it, where there are relatively few stars, okay? That's why in this picture you only see just a handful, boom, 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 boom. But as you look, these are our neighbors, okay? They're out of focus because they're right up close. They're in our galaxy, right? But then what do you see? Those of you up front may be able to see it a little better. What do you see in the background? What's actually in focus? Galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies. Like these spiral galaxies here, this will be just like ours, right? Okay? I'm sure some of these dots are stars, but mostly they're galaxies. Okay? There's something like a billion galaxies. Okay, in our universe. And each one of them has something like a billion stars in it. Okay? Those numbers are just meaningless, right? There are literally more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on all the beaches in all the world. Okay? I've said before, this is one of the profound images humanity's ever captured. I believe that. Okay. So is this a picture of the night sky? Huh? Is this a picture of the night sky? Yes or no? Yes. Okay, thank you. Sorry, that was such a tough question. Okay, now, what is this? Huh? This is Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh. Okay, I'm sure probably know art history a lot better than I do. But old Van Gogh, or how would you actually pronounce his name? Somebody know that? Van, huh? Van Ha, right? Something like that. Anyway, he was Dutch, right? Okay, and he was kind of crazy, right? He suffered from mental illness. Okay, early in his life, he was actually, you know, I suppose he was religious all through his life, but early in his life, he actually worked as a missionary, you know, and his uncle was this pretty prominent theologian. In 1888, in a dispute with his friend and fellow artist Gauguin, he had this disagreement with him. Then what did he do after that? Cut off his ear. Right. And so people thought, that's not normal. And so where did Van Gogh end up? In an asylum. Yeah. In an insane asylum. Yeah. And something tells me that an asylum in 1888 is not exactly like the mental health institutions of our day. Would you agree, Troy? Yeah. Okay, so in 1889, in this asylum, Van Gogh painted Starry Night. This is reported to be, his interpretation of a view, his expression of a view from the asylum. You see the moon, and you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 stars, right? Why are there 11 stars? Maybe it's coincidental, but have you ever heard, anybody know, here's your hard question. Where are 11 stars mentioned in the Bible? Harris? Nope. Sorry. There is in Revelation. You're right. Genesis. What about in Genesis?
About the sons of Joseph's dream.
Man, that's impressive, right? Yeah, Joseph, his He did something not very bright. He had these dreams, which was not unbright part, but then he told his brothers about them. His dreams are all these different expressions of the same idea. So he told his brothers, hey, look, I dreamed that all the 11 stars bowed down to me. You know, he had these series of dreams about how that his brothers would serve him and bow down to him as the younger brother. And it says, the 11 stars bowed down to me. People think that was something kind of going through Van Gogh's mind in this asylum, and that these 11 stars are about vindication and about hope for the future. Because here he was in this asylum, everyone in the world thought he was absolutely crazy and worthless and, you know, just completely wrong and off the rails. And this image is actually one of hope. And vindication. I don't know. It's a very captivating image, regardless. I mean, for well over 200 years now. You know, Van Gogh died before he was really recognized for the genius that he was. But for 200 years now, people have absolutely been captivated by this image, right? Okay. So is this a picture of the night sky? Yeah. Okay. So this is a picture of the night sky, right? And this is a picture of the night sky, right? Okay. Is this true? Yes. Is this meaningful? Yes. Is this true? Is this meaningful? Yeah. So, the question is, Genesis 1, this kind of picture, or is Genesis 1 this kind of picture? Does it have elements of both, or does it have elements of a whole different genre of art? I don't know. Different people lean different ways, right? Different people interact with things in different ways. Different people see different things when they look at the sky, right? Let's think about what, and we can't possibly put ourselves into the mind of ancient peoples, right? They undoubtedly thought incredibly differently from the way we did, right? So the closest thing we can do, you know, it's the closest thing we can do is look at what their art, their literature that they left behind, right? And maybe try to, you know, not even understand the way they thought, but just get some hints, some glimpses. Okay? These next few passages are from the Enuma Elish, which was a Babylonian, not necessarily just creation myth, but the creation of the earth is kind of secondary into the Enuma Elish. It's mostly about their pantheon of the gods and how they interacted and how the world came to be the way it is and how the gods are the way they are, right? And it begins, they think the Enuma Elish originally began with Hammurabi, which would be, you know, 1700s AD, you know, fairly contemporary with Noah and his guys after, right? But as it, and that was the old Babylonian empire, the first rise of Babylon when it first came to prominence in the 1700s. Did I say AD a minute ago? Yes. Sorry. Hopefully you know I meant BC. Hammurabi Code was not written 150 years ago, okay? All right. So the 1800s BC, when this mythology, the Enuma Elish, and the name Enuma Elish starts in the beginning, went in the heavens. In other words, went in the heights is what Enuma Elish means. Okay, that it originally began with the first rise of Babylon and the old Babylonian Empire in the 1800s BC. But it was in this form. It kind of changed. It kind of evolved through the years into the form we have now, which mostly came from the 600s, 500s BC, concurrent or contemporary with Nehemiah and his guys and the Neo-Babylonian Empire that captured the kingdom of Judah, okay? So these people, either way you want to look at it, the people from who left Ur, who left the Mesopotamia, journeyed across the Levant, across the Fertile Crescent in the 1800s, the Abrahamites and his people would have been familiar with the old and new Middle East, whatever it looked like, or maybe it was just exactly like this, or the people who, Nehemiah's day, who came out of their captivity in Babylon, they would have also been familiar with this version of Enuma Elish, okay? Right? So anyway, this span, this great swath of time, these 1,200 years in the biblical time span, Enuma Elish was around. Okay, so let's read some. I shouldn't have put it up here because a lot of y'all have been reading it already, right? Tablet 1, this is the prologue, right? When the heavens above did not exist and the earth beneath had not come into being, there's Apsu, the first in order, their begetter, and the demiurge Tiamat, who gave birth to them all. They had mingled their waters together before meadowland had coalesced and reed bed was to be found. So you have these two, and they're over, everything is covered with water, right? When not one of the gods had been formed or had come into being, when no destinies had been decreed, the gods were created with them. See, just a little, not necessarily similarity and pattern, but just the same idea that Genesis 1 begins with, right? You see that? Just me? Kind of the same thing. Let's read Genesis 1 again. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. When in the heavens above did not exist, and the earth beneath had not come into being, there was Apsu, the first in order, their begetter. And the demiurge, which means creator, or the creatress in this case, Tiamat, who gave birth to them all. They mingled their waters together. Before meadowland had coalesced and reedbed was to be found, when not one of the gods had been formed or had come into being, and no destinies had been decreed, the gods were created within them. You see, kind of a hint of the same, you know, for sure. Now, you can't really go from there and pick out all these other similarities between the content of the Enuma Elish and the content of Genesis 1 because it's, you know, totally different. You know, Genesis 1 is basically this story of God making everything, God making chaos, and out of that chaos bringing disorder and order, and then step by step, sequentially, more and more and more and more order. First of all, it's formless and empty and void, just chaos. And then above that chaos, you have water separating the waters and dry land. You have sky and you have dry land. And then you have inhabitants of all these habitats, more and more and more order, more and more and more function, more and more material and more function, more stuff. This is a progression all the way through. Well, here you just start out with really there's water all over the place. There's these gods. And then they start having kids, and it just goes downhill from there. The kids are too loud. And so one of them decides that these little gods make too much noise, so he's going to kill them all. And that starts off a war between various kinds of gods, right? And eventually, Tiamat, the creatress, is slain, and her skin is stretched out over the earth to make this vault, to make the firmament, to keep the waters up there. You have a vault. There's something solid in the sky. Why? Because rain sometimes comes down, right? So there's water up there, and there's something holding that water up. So in this case, it's the skin of Tiamat stretched over the earth, this vault, this firmament. And then they knock off the old man, and out of his blood they form humans. I might be getting ahead of myself. I might have to mess up in here. So he makes humans. And then Marduk, one of the kids, who comes to prominence, he's the wisest and smartest, the best of them all. He leads this rebellion that saves the kids, saves the little gods. And when Marduk heard the god's speech, this is all the way in Tablet 6, he conceived a desire to accomplish clever things. He opened his mouth in addressing Ea. He counsels that which he had pondered in his heart. I will bring together blood to form bone. I will bring into being Lulu, or a savage, you know, different ways of putting that. Bringing together Luyu, whose name shall be man. I will create Luyu, man, on whom the toil of the gods will be laid, that they may rest. Okay. So, the Enumelish, and for a huge swath of the ancient world anyway, why did people exist? Why did people exist? Yeah. On whom the toil of the gods will be laid, that they may rest, that the gods can rest. So the humans were made, what made these humans, so they can do the drudge work. So the gods can sit back and take it easy, right? Now, what sort of things were the drudge work of the gods that people needed to do? You know, flash forward in, you know, to this period in history. You're a priest. You're telling people that they need to do the work of God. What was the work of God? You need to raise your crops. And you need to do what with a big part of it? You need to bring it to the temple. You need to sacrifice it, which means you need to let us have it, right? Because they literally fed their gods, their deities. You literally, their sacrifices, you were literally, in many cases, you were literally bringing produce of the work of your hands and produce of the ground. You were literally bringing it before the deity, before the god, right? In this room. And the priests, you know, you would bring it in and you would lay it before the deity and the priest would close this curtain. And then while you prayed, at some point, the god would eat it, you know, like he does, right? So you open the curtain and where's the food? Ah, God's eating it. All right. But why was it important for people to know that they should bring all this stuff to the deity? And then to serve, and then to also bring it to the king, who was himself, you know, in some weird ways, a representative, a servant, and a deified in himself, but he's at the very least a servant of the deities. He had this authority of the deities, the authority of the gods. So you put on your cynical hat here, and why does this say to bring all of your stuff to the king and to the priest? Who wrote this? Yeah, the priests. Yeah. Now, let's go farther. Tablet 5 says Marduk again, okay. Now, this the pantheon of these gods was shared over many of the civilizations and empires in Mesopotamia, right? So the names of the gods was very similar in the Neo-Babylonian Empire, as it was in the Old Babylonian Empire, as it was in the Akkadian Empire. Well, the Akkadians, which, you know, kind of subsumed and conquered and kind of unified all the Sumerian civilizations, you know, the really, really old civilizations, Sumerian civilizations. So the Sumerians, Akkadians, Sumerians slash Akkadians, okay, and the Old Babylonians and the Neo-Babylonians, and then so the other various peoples on the periphery of all this, they all shared the same god names, right? But it wasn't until, you know, the rise of the Babylonians, which was much, much later, okay? Babylon was just a village in the old Sumerian kingdom days, right? It wasn't until the rise of the Babylonians that Marduk started to be seen as the chief god. Okay, because Marduk was the god of Babylon. Okay, remember, each of these cities across the Fertile Crescent would have had their temple, and they would have had their deity for that city. Okay, like Ishtar for Nineveh. And I don't know all any of the others, okay? So if you wanted to worship Ishtar, and whatever she was the god of, you would journey to Nineveh. That's where Ishtar lived. That was Ishtar's city. If you wanted to worship Marduk or to, you know, get whatever Marduk gives people, you go to Babylon, right? And as Babylon rose to prominence, you start seeing in their literature and in their mythologies and their religious, you know, stuff, Marduk is the top god, right? So now Marduk opened his mouth to speak and addressed the gods, his fathers. It says, above the Apsu, the emerald abode, and opposite Isara, which I built for you, beneath the celestial parts, whose floor I made firm with his mom's skin, I will build a house to be my luxurious abode. Within it, I will establish its shrine. I will found my chamber and establish my kingship. When you come up from the Apsu to make a decision, that he's addressing all the other gods. So when you gods come up from the realm of the gods, the emerald abode, you can stop here. This will be your resting place before the assembly. When you descend from heaven to make a decision, this will be your resting place for the assembly. So you gods, all you other gods, I'm making this place, this amazing best place in the whole world, that whether you're coming from the emerald abode or to the heavens, you can stop here and you can rest in this amazing, beautiful, best place ever. All right? I shall call its name Babylon, the homes of the great gods. Okay. So, what else is the Enuma Elish? It's propaganda for Babylon. See what I'm talking about? So all these gods' stories have been in existence for thousands of years since the Sumerians and the Akkadians. Babylon did not exist. Right? And now that Babylon has risen to prominence politically, geopolitically, it's now, you go back and it's the best place in the world. Marduk made it for all of you gods to hang out. This is the most awesome, best place ever. You see? So what do you get from the Enuma Elish? As a person, what you get from it is Babylon is the best place ever. I owe all my allegiance, all my service, all of my money, everything to Babylon, because Marduk is the hero of the gods, and he's the destroyer of the gods, and he lives here. He made this place for everyone. He made this place for all the gods. Babylon, right? You see what I'm talking about? Yeah. Okay. Now, so, coming from that world, okay, where people tell you, your priests tell you, that you were made to serve the gods. And by the way, the gods live in Babylon. Bring all your stuff here. You know, your importance, your dignity comes from how much you can give the gods. Right? That's, you were made to be slaves. You were made to be cattle for the gods. Bring them your stuff. All right? Bring it to Babylon. Okay, do you see? That's the point. How incredibly countercultural would it be? How different then does this sound? Because God saw all he had made. It was very good. There was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. How incredibly countercultural would it be to hear God, the one God who made it all. Not one of them, not the God who resides over there or the God who resides over here or the God you need to travel over there to get to. The God, the one God who made it all says, let us make human beings in our image. To be like us. They will reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the wild animals on the earth, and all the small animals that scurry along the ground. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and govern it. Reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, and all the animals that scurry along the ground. And that really is, you know, this is kind of the climax of Genesis 1. kind of the whole point you get to. How different is that? That is radical. Right? That is the opposite of the Enuma Elish. That's the opposite of all these other creation stories that you've come across. This is something completely wild, completely new, completely different. And this is something incredibly uplifting, incredibly dignifying, incredibly challenging, and incredibly beautiful. What you've heard all of your life is that you are just a slave for the gods, and you are a slave to the king. All you need to worry about is raising plenty of crops and bringing your wealth and mining plenty of stuff and trading and all this stuff and bringing your wealth to the gods, because that's what you were made for. That's all you've heard all your life. You're just a slave. Then you're this. Because you are like God. You are like God. He made you to be like Him. He made you to do what He does. This God who brings order out of chaos. This God who is creative. This God who is beautiful and does beautiful things. This God who builds and makes and crafts and speaks. You are made to do what He does. Which would you choose if you had two options? In the image of God, He created them to be fruitful. And see, we get so hung up on what image of God means, but it explains what it's talking about. It's about function. It's about role. The image of God is a vocation. Among other things, but it's a vocation. It says, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth, just like God does. And govern it. Manage it, just like God does. Reign over the fish in the sea. Manage the fish in the sea. The birds in the sky and all the animals that scurry along the ground. You really have this sense of God creating and continuing to create. Don't get me wrong. Creating and continuing to create all of this amazing cosmos. And then handing over a huge chunk of that, what He is doing, to people. To me and to you. Right? So, when did all this happen? Is that a question this text even seeks to address? You can take the Bible very, very, very seriously. And arguably remain very, very faithful to the text, and read this as a factual and literal recipe of how God made the world. And you can be very, very serious about the Bible, and I would argue very faithful to the text, and read it in other ways. When did it happen? How did God do all this? Who knows? Who cares? That's not the point of this passage. The point of this passage, number one, is who God is, where it all came from, and number two, is who you are. And this passage was so incredibly countercultural in its day. For striking down the propaganda of Babylon and for bringing dignity and purpose to humans. And it is just as countercultural today. Not because it says the earth was made a certain amount of time ago when the culture around us says it's much older. It's countercultural today because the culture around us says you are an accident. And this says you are anything but an accident. You are the culmination of creation. What does this say about you? We're supposed to be thinking about bringing joy, you know, out of these texts, and loving God and loving people in these texts, right? How does this make you love God? Does this text lead you to love God or not? Yeah. If this is true, does this lead you to love God more? Yeah. You know, whether this is a Hubble Space Telescope image or whether it's a Van Gogh image, whichever, does either one make you love God more? Yes. He made everything. And He made me. I am incredibly important to Him. Does this make you love other people more? It should. Because He made them too. Because they are incredibly important to Him too. Does it bring joy? And think about it. You know, it can seem... It seems selfish to think about it. There's literally nothing else in the universe. There's nothing else in the universe that was created that's more important to God than I am, right? That can seem selfish and prideful to think that. But let's think about it in a different way. Let's read this passage first. O Lord, our Lord, your majestic name fills the earth. Your glory is higher than the heavens. You have taught children and infants to tell of your strength, silencing your enemies and all who oppose you. When I look at the night sky and I see the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars you set in place, what are mere mortals that you should think about them? You think about a billion stars, that galaxy swirling all over the universe. What are mere mortals that you should think about them? Human beings that you should care for them. Yet you made them only a little lower than God. This is the word Elohim. You can translate it as God or angels or heavenly beings. It's about half and half. Anyway. Yet you made them only a little lower than Elohim and crowned them with glory and honor. What are mere mortals that you should think about them? Human beings that you should care for them. You made them only a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. If it seems selfish to think about yourself being the most important thing in the universe to the one who made it. Lots of you are parents in here, right? How does it feel to know that your child, your child, there is literally nothing that has ever been created in this universe that is more important to God than your child. Yeah. How does that feel? Yeah. Does that bring joy? You gave them charge of everything you made, putting all things under their authority, the flocks and the herds and all the wild animals, the birds in the sky, the fish in the sea, and everything that swims in the ocean currents. Oh Lord, our Lord, your majestic name fills the earth.